97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
Well, good afternoon on a Wednesday, as there's like a ton of stuff going on. This is one of those days where I feel like we can do the roulette wheel of topics, right, Fred? I can't turn everyone's mics on. Sorry about that, Fred. I can't keep track of microphones. It's beyond my pay grade at this time. But yeah, but it's like the roulette of topics today, isn't it?
Yeah. Is there ever a slow day for us lately?
I don't think so. But here's what I would say, you know, just as an American, as we get started here. And I think this is pretty important because gas prices are down. We're celebrating our independence, right? Our nation's independence this week. Gas prices are down. Butter's down. The stock market is in record territory. And damn it, we still have the right in this country to do freak-offs whenever we want because of the Diddy trial. Sue, are you up to speed on all that?
Oh, I heard some of it. So some convictions, not all of it.
Well, and they're going to announce here within a matter of minutes, they may just set him free. And,
what?
You know, well, until sentencing. Oh. You know, he's still going to be sentenced, but they may just let him go. I think the trend, Fred, isn't that what you've heard?
Yeah, ankle bracelet maybe, but just not
He might just get to walk out, and you know, then he's going to be sentenced. But when I was listening to a lot of the coverage earlier, it didn't seem like anyone was seriously predicting that he was going to spend any amount of time in prison that would be
awful.
Along the lines of what we expected. Now, look, I kind of joked about how we have the right to freak offs. The question, I think, and Brad Young's going to address some of this, is some of this was consensual. I mean, there were second thoughts given in the aftermath of what might have happened. But in the foremath, is that a word, by the way? Before it happened, it was consensual, right?
So, well, except you have to think about, were they so afraid of him that to say no would risk your life?
Right. No, and I get that.
But so I'm not sure I call that consent.
I'm not saying that it's right. Don't get me wrong. Don't misinterpret what I'm saying. I'm just saying that they clearly the jury had a trouble. And, you know, one of the things Paul Morrow said, and we'll get into this with Brad Young, is that jury came in fast. Like yesterday afternoon, all this was breaking yesterday afternoon.
Yeah.
And we were given, I think that it's fair to say there were mixed signals on that. But
there are a lot of questions.
I think they probably wanted it over with, but that's just how long did this go on? Weeks?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Weeks, and we didn't, we didn't cover it for the longest time either. So, I mean, we don't, this is what I've said. It's really hard to get a handle on some of this stuff when you don't follow it on an everyday basis.
True.
No matter what the trial is, sometimes we've sat here and we've been very confused by some of the verdicts and things that have happened. And it's been, tough to get a handle on. Now, the bigger story today is the Koberger case. Sue, are you dialed into what happened there?
No, what happened today?
This was the plea deal. So he goes into court, and he's there with his team, and he pleads guilty. And this is, this kind of played a little bit more, I would say, like an opening statement in a trial,
yeah.
Where they start the trial. Maybe even they had the opening statement ready to go because it was a situation where the judge allowed a few things to happen today. Koberger was there. He did plead guilty. This is, this is the DA who at a certain point in all this starts to tell everyone, I'm not going to say the jury because the jury's not there. There is no jury. What the case is all about and the facts of the case.
Defendant entered the residence, went to the third floor, and with a knife, killed Madison Mogan and Caitlin Gonzalez. The defendant, as he left that room, for whatever reason, ended up leaving, or the sheath for a K-bar knife was left on the bed next to Madison Mogan's body. The state's evidence would show that Zanna Knodel was still awake at this time. In fact, had taken a DoorDash order not long before this started. Her room's not on the third floor. It was on the second floor on the west side. As the defendant was either coming down the stairs or leaving, he encountered Zanna, and he ended up killing her, also with a large knife. Ethan Chapin, Zanna's boyfriend, was asleep in their bedroom, in her bedroom, and the defendant killed him as well.
Now, this was interesting. Jeez. Also, there's a lot of conjecture. We'll see what Brad thinks. We had Paul Morrow on yesterday wondering why this happened. Was there something with the DNA evidence? And again, it's not they found DNA on the sheath of the knife. I think that they got that. But what they also did, and this is where Brad has thrown red flags on this before. So, Sue, we're always fascinated by this. And I think it's I'm okay with it, but you'll hear what Brad has to say. So if you go to the garbage can like they did, you get the DNA, right? That's fine. That's legal. You can do that. But then the FBI goes to 23andMe, for example. I don't know that it was that service, but that's one of the things that they do. And 23andMe says, yeah, this is the dude. And I don't think it was, you know, that particular service. But, you know, that's where the legalese gets a little tricky. And apparently the defense may have had something. But this is what the DA says.
Koberger entered the residence at 1122 King Road in Moscow, Idaho. He did that with the intent to kill. We will not represent that he intended to commit all of the murders that he did that night.
That's an interesting statement right there. Hear what he says? Because, like, even in the, I may have played this a little bit backwards here, because what he outlines is the fact that, you know, this other, I don't think it was it Kaylee or it was Zanna? They had the DoorDash order, right? So, you know.
That was unexpected.
Exactly.
Know that that is what resulted. And that he then killed intentionally, willfully, deliberately, with premeditation and with malice forethought, Manny Mogan, Kaylee Gonzalez, Ethan Chapin, and Santa Cruz.
He got emotional. And this should be emotional. Look, you had four people whose lives brutally, brutally murdered, right? And now he's pleading guilty. Now, what's interesting is, we'll break this down a little bit this afternoon as well, is some of the family members are okay with it. Some of the family members are not okay with it.
Yep.
So there's a little bit of a split. Some people are saying, look, you take the four murder convictions. Even I've heard legal analysts today say, you take the four murder convictions. How often do you get that anyway? In a case where we've seen what's happened with Diddy.
Right.
So you can go in with all the confidence in the world. The other thing is there's appeals and things that can be brought up, and then this drags on and on and on. But here's what happened with Brian Koberger. He sits there and he answers questions from the judge.
Did you, on November 13th, 2022... enter the residence at 1122 King Road in Moscow, Idaho, with the intent to commit the felony crime of murder?
Yes.
Did you, on November 13th, 2022, in Latah County, state of Idaho, kill and murder Madison Mogan, a human being?
Yes.
And did you do that willfully, unlawfully, deliberately, and with premeditation and malice aforethought?
Yes.
Did you on or about that same date in Moscow, Idaho, kill and murder Kaylee Gonzalez, a human being?
Yes.
And did you do that willfully, unlawfully, deliberately, and with premeditation and malice aforethought?
Yes.
And did you on that same date in Moscow, Idaho, kill and murder Zanna Kernodle, a human being?
Yes.
And did you do that willfully, unlawfully, deliberately, with premeditation and malice aforethought?
Yes.
And then on or about November 13th, 2022, again in Latah County, Idaho, did you kill and murder Ethan Chapin, a human being?
Yes.
Did you do that willfully, unlawfully, deliberately, with premeditation and malice aforethought?
Yes.
I mean, it was all very matter of fact.
Mark.
I thought the judge, by the way, Fred, I don't know about you, I thought the judge did a fantastic job guiding people through this.
Well, he did. Are we assuming that he has admitted to this just to avoid the death penalty?
I don't know. I think that's part of the question. And I'm not sure. There's a lot of things that are going to come, you know, with this thing that we will never know. So the judge asks him this question.
And do you understand the nature of the charges that are... that you've been charged with, that I understand you're going to plead guilty today to?
Yes.
Are you pleading guilty because you are guilty?
Yes.
So he just says yes every time.
At one point, he
stood up and the judge says, you know, because he had to be sworn in, and the judge said, Mr. Koberger, you don't have to stand up if you don't want to. And he sat there with his defense team and he just said, yes, yes, yes. You know, no emotion, nothing like that. You can hear the emotion from the prosecutor, obviously, but nothing from Koberger.
One thing that I found interesting, the judge said to him, was you realize by making these pleas, you're giving up your right to appeal at any time.
Yes.
Oh,
and
interesting.
Yes. But I don't know that it gives him the, it still gives him the ability if he wants to write a book, if he wants to do an interview, if he wants to do something like that. I think that's what pisses off some of the family members. Here's one of the fathers here.
It's my daughter. It's our children. How can you say it's just when you haven't even talked to us? They told you it's not really about us. It's about their process. Just shut up and get on board and deal with it. That's really what they told us. Idaho's failed. They failed me. They failed my whole family.
Okay, so, but by the very same token, as I'm driving in today, I heard one of the attorneys for other family members saying, look, we accept this plea. We think it was the right move. So there is a split in the victims, and they, I guess they had to try to do the right thing. Now, Phil Holloway, a couple of days ago, you might remember, and we'll talk to Brad Young about this in a couple of minutes. Usually what happens is they do meet with the victims' families, right? And
right.
they say, look, this is what's going to go down. And, you know, are you cool with this? Here's Nancy Grace talking about this. She's not very happy about it at all.
Technical legal term, it's BS. I feel that the family was left out of the equation. I've got the letter that they sent the family. A letter? Really? A letter instead of a meeting? Listen, there is DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, on the murder weapon she found under the dead body. What more do you really need? I find this weak. It sounds to me like somebody didn't have the spine to take the case to trial.
I am confused by it.
It does sound that
way. I don't get it because, you know, I do understand. Look, it'd be one thing if all of the victims' families were on the same page and they said to the prosecution, we don't want to go through all this. We don't want to have to be there. This is one of those trials that would have taken weeks, if not months, right? We don't want to have to hear this evidence about our own children, our brothers, our sisters, time and time and time again. That's one scenario. But clearly, we don't have that scenario. We have a different scenario where they somehow cut to the chase here. There's a variety of theories of why they may have done it. You know, just from a, I don't know if you're a family member, do you want to know the motive?
We want to know
the motive because we're curious about this stuff and we love Dateline and all that other stuff. But
Mark, how would you feel? One of your kids.
Yeah, I'd want to know.
Would you?
I would want to know.
Would you want this where there is no trial and you don't get to hear from him and it's just that's it?
My gut tells me, this is real easy to say because it wasn't my child, but my gut tells me, no, I would want this to be on full display. And by the way, I'm a death penalty proponent, so I would want the death penalty. But Brad Young, who is our legal expert and often fills in on this show, he's going to guide us through this. You have all kinds of crazy stuff today. University of Pennsylvania caving to the Trump administration.
So great.
On Leah Thomas. Outstanding. I have great Riley Gaines audio, Paul Scanlon on that. We have the Paramount settlement, too, with Trump. So that's a big deal as well. All of that coming up here on 97.1 FM Talk. So Brad Young's going to join in just a second, but I want to piggyback off of something that Paul Morrow's. And by the way, as you remember yesterday, Paul Morrow from Fox was with us. He's got the great website, theopsdesk.org. And the only thing that he told Fred when we set it up is, you know, unless the Diddy verdict comes in, like during the interview, the Diddy verdict comes in. But, you know, the question, as we indicated with the Koberger situation, is, why did they do this? Like, why would the prosecution do this if not all the families were on board? So Paul Morrow, and he mentioned this yesterday, maybe there's DNA concerns, right?
Generally, the rule is nationwide in every state and even federally that if you leave garbage at the curb, it's abandoned and it's fair game. You only have to get a search warrant in situations where it's inside a house, et cetera. Where you might, though, but your antenna are firing off accurately, because where you might have had trouble is the initial scrub of the DNA that they did. Once they got the touch DNA off the hasp of the knife sheath, they sent it in to the various commercial companies that store DNA profiles from people who have used those commercial companies. And my understanding, according to the reporting, is that it was the FBI that took charge of that, and they sent it in as a client and not as law enforcement. So
that's
where, that has been a theory.
Yeah, that's maybe where you get in trouble. Let me welcome Brad Young into the fray here this afternoon. Hi, Brad. You know, on that point in particular, you've mentioned that before as something that you're not comfortable with, right?
Right. Because, listen, if there's anything wrong with the DNA was certainly the strongest evidence with Koberger. There was a lot of other, though, other evidence, like the cell phone pings, with the cell tower of him making dry runs by the house. I mean, there was just an overwhelming amount of evidence. But when you boil it all down, I think the real issue here isn't that they took a plea deal, because you're always going to want to take a plea deal to get life in prison,
right,
just to avoid the uncertainty that a cockamamie jury doesn't go your way.
Yeah, exactly.
The main issue that I have is that the prosecution did not require Koberger to explain why he did it, how he did it, and what was the motivation for him doing it. Listen, prosecutors can can require, as part of a plea deal, that you dress up a clown and sing Howdy Doody songs. Okay, you can require anything in conjunction with the plea deal. And yet the prosecutors, I think that's where they dropped the boat, because these family members need closure. They need to know, why was my child killed? Why? I know you're a monster, but why did you do this?
So,
and they're being deprived of that just because the prosecutors failed to require.
Okay, so I indicated there's a split in the families. Not all the family members think this was a bad deal. There was a defense attorney, and I can't keep track of the names, and I apologize, because those are the people who are important, the victims here. But some of the family members have said, yeah, this is a good deal. There was an attorney that came out a couple hours ago. But what would be the motivation to not do that, Brad, and to say, look, we have, you're going to give you this deal. We're not going to put you in front of a firing squad, which is interesting. There's a firing squad. But why would they have that motivation to say, we don't want to know why you did this? It doesn't make any sense, that part.
Well, without talking to the prosecutors, I have no idea. I'm just speculating. Maybe they didn't realize they could do it. I mean, these are Idaho prosecutors. How many times have they been in these types of situations? We don't know. But listen, I know a lot of the people here are complaining that they took a plea deal. I really don't have a problem with it, especially when you look at our modern death penalty situation. Even if he were convicted and the death penalty were given, he'd be on death row for 20, 30 years.
Unfortunately, yes, you're right about that.
Brad, does that indicate then that the prosecution thought, you know what, maybe our case isn't ironclad, or is it just that versus the risk? Because if they did run that DNA saying, oh, we're a family member, we're not doing this as a governmental body or a police organization. Were they worried about that? Maybe would that play a role?
Well, there's always risk generally, Sue. But even here, if you, as the defense, if the defense could shake and rattle the jury with regard to the effectiveness of the DNA, then that's really the only thing that placed him at the crime scene. Otherwise, you've got bushy eyebrows and you've got circumstantial evidence
cell
of
phone
him driving
pings,
around.
Though, yeah, they right. had the cell phone
Well, but
pings.
The cell phone pings were not on the night of the murder.
Okay.
They were the night where he was casing the place. But even that's circumstantial, because you didn't have cell phone pings on the night of the murder because he left his cell phone at his house, which in of itself is evidence, right? But it's all circumstantial evidence. Only the DNA placed him at that scene. And if the defense could shake that, then it becomes a risk. So, I do believe that taking this plea deal was in the best interest of justice. I just wish the prosecutors would have moved forward and had Koberger explain why he did it, because that would have given some closure to the family members.
I think it makes 100% positive, it makes sense if that happens and if the family members are on board. And the way it came together so quickly, and we'll hear, I'm sure we're going to hear more from the family members. They'll be interviewed. They'll do news conferences. They'll explain maybe what happened in this situation, but it is very confusing. Let's move on to Diddy, because apparently, the jury didn't think that there was a whole lot of evidence here to convict this guy on all the charges. He was convicted of some, but they're supposed to make an announcement this afternoon. They may let him go before sentencing is what I understand, Brad.
It's possible. I wouldn't classify it as probable.
Oh, good.
But here, because for him, if he gets house arrest, from the judge's perspective, is being house arrest in the P. Diddy mansion, is that really being in jail? No, it's not.
Nope.
So I don't think that the judge, it certainly is possible, but I'm not predicting that the judge is going to release him tonight. They're going to wait for sentencing. But listen, the prosecution here has really screwed up, and I'll tell you how. The big charge in the P. Diddy case was the RICO, the racketeering charge. And you know from any mob trial that you've ever heard of that you have to have other witnesses testify about the conspiracy. You know, the chef in the Italian restaurant has to testify that the mob boss paid him money to get rid of a body or something along those lines. In this instance, the prosecution produced zero witnesses related to the RICO charge. They didn't produce any other witnesses that said, P. Diddy contacted me and arranged for me to do X, Y, or Z. There was none of that evidence. So literally, the jury could not have convicted him and shouldn't have convicted him on the RICO charge because there was no evidence of any guilt. That really, if they would have put together more witnesses on the witness list to testify about the conspiracy, then Diddy would have been locked up for life.
Don't you think, you know, and I said this in the open, it's very difficult. And I've covered trials before, way back in the day. I've been through like the very opening statements, through closing arguments, through the jury coming in for murder trials in Columbia, Missouri. And I've always had to admit, you know, a lot of that stuff, by the way, is very boring. There's stuff that, you know how this goes on with trials. So it's not as sexy as people think. But in this particular case, we're not paying all, you know, close attention to what happened, because it's being covered probably more in New York or in the Hollywood trades than anywhere else. And then you get to this point and you say, wait a second, how is that possible based on the information that we know? And there's no doubt that there was salacious stuff, there was disgusting stuff that happened. The question is, and you just kind of pointed this out, these RICO cases are very, very hard to prove, right?
Well, they are, but you have to have evidence, and they didn't prove any evidence. But talking about evidence, though, juries, and let's go to the Cassie Ventura and the Jane Doe, who both testified that they were forced to have sex with these male escorts on multiple occasions, and they were also forced to have sex with P. Diddy. Traditionally, juries are often reluctant to convict celebrities on sex trafficking charges because it becomes difficult to determine if the girlfriend was or was not being coerced into sex. And what happens on cross-examination of Cassie, and we saw this with her and the Jane Doe, the questions are, did you ever have consensual sex with P. Diddy? Well, yes, I did. Yeah. But you're saying on these occasions it was not consensual. That's right. And it becomes difficult for a jury to say, well, sometimes it's consensual and sometimes it's not. How do we know when it was or when it wasn't? So that, to me, it wasn't shocking that the jury acquitted on those charges, simply because it becomes a he said, she said, and by definition, oftentimes that meets the definition of reasonable doubt.
By the way, they came in very quickly. We have to touch on this, though. So last fall, during the election, we're leading up to the election, Kamala Harris goes on 60 Minutes. They released some of the audio in advance of this. I remember playing it. And then they play some on Face the Nation, but they edited it in a very convenient way.
Well, let's start with October 7th. 1,200 people were massacred. 250 hostages were taken, including Americans. Women were brutally raped. And as I said then, I maintain Israel has a right to defend itself. We would. And how it does so matters.
So, you know, basically, I don't want to play all the audio there, but Trump takes issue with CBS News airing two different portions of the response to the question about the Middle East. And, you know, he sues. He gets $16 million, which part of which will be allocated to his future presidential library and plaintiff's fees and costs. By the way, how was Texas Congressman Ronnie Jackson a part of this case? Because the story that I saw said that neither Mr. Trump nor his co-plaintiff will directly be paid as part of the settlement.
You know, I don't really know. I mean, I understand that that he played a role in it, but I'm not exactly sure why.
Yeah,
Congressman
that's weird.
Jackson. I'm not sure.
But on that particular, I mean, everyone kind of saw this coming, right? That they were going to settle this lawsuit.
Yes. And first of all, as I like to always say, since a big part of this settlement is going to go to pay the lawyers, my wife says it's always good when the lawyers get paid. So, that's my standard comment. But getting to the merits of this, it does show that the media can be held accountable when they purposefully and knowingly slant the news in order to support their own political agenda. And I'm certainly glad that 60 Minutes was held accountable here.
By the way, $16 million is a little less than the $20 billion. He initially sought $10 billion in damages, and then he upped it to $20 billion in February. I guess he'll take the $16 billion because he wins yet again. I mean, look, he's scoring victories. I don't know if he's going to get the big, beautiful bill passed into his desk this week, but there's no doubt that he's scoring victory after victory. Brad, I appreciate your help this afternoon. Always great.
Yeah, thank you. Very quickly, though, you said billions. He only collects about $16 billion, maybe up to a million. It may be up to $30 million. He was demanding in the billions, but the settlement is in the millions.
Yeah, right. I didn't know if I made that. Maybe I misspoke there, but I appreciate it. Thank you, Brad Young. All my predictions on the big, beautiful bill have been wrong up until this point, but I do think that they're still up against it. You have Chip Roy as a holdout, and then a couple others. Jason Smith, the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. Look, that is the tax writing committee. He played a huge role in crafting this legislation, getting it through the House and passing it to the Senate. He was on Fox earlier today. Is it going to pass this week? Look, they still want this passed in the House in the next couple of days so the president can sign it by Friday.
We definitely will. This is a process. We knew that this was going to be a process because it's a huge, historic piece of legislation, and you have to carefully thread the needle, and that's what we're going to do. What we're voting on right now, as you see on the board, is an amendment to the overall rule, and then the next vote is the rule that we'll be voting on. But We'll have the votes in passing.
So yesterday, Chip Roy said this, and he's one of the holdouts right now.
This is the Senate wanting to try to save some for their home states, like Senator Murkowski for Alaska, trying to get giveaways to perpetuate the Medicaid money laundering scam in Alaska. It may not be today. It may not be this week. But we're going to deliver on the tax cuts, spending cuts, and the border funding necessary to save this country.
So he has optimism on those three points. But look, all this is grouped together, and he doesn't like what happened in the Senate.
This is deals that was cut with Republicans in order to try to get this bill through the Senate. And it is going to undermine the good things we did in the House to deliver on the president's agenda.
All right.
The president wants the tax cuts. He wanted the Green New Scam terminated. We need it all. And I think we're going to have some more work to do after this week to get this done.
All right. David Strom from HotAir.com is with us this afternoon. Chip Roy sounding like, no, this is not going to get to the president's desk. David, do you think that this will get to the president's desk by the 4th of July? Jason Smith is very confident. I didn't think they'd get it through the Senate. They got it through the Senate. So I've been wrong about a lot of these things leading up to this point.
You're going to put me on the spot, aren't you?
Well, I'm putting everyone on the spot. I mean, right now it's just a gut check. We don't know. I mean, that, you know, one of the frustrations I have is all this wrangling, all this stuff behind the scenes. Nobody, even if they voted on it in the Senate, they didn't read the whole damn thing. They don't know all the implications. There's no way you can convince me of that. And the House members are just trying to get something across the line. Now, I think it does indicate that Trump's got a pretty good grip on these guys. He had people over to the White House. He was, you know, doing some backdoor pressure here this afternoon, but I don't know what's going to happen, because you put that deadline on. Trump seemingly, David, a couple of days ago said, well, you know, he seemed to loosen up on the July 4th thing, but they want this victory before Independence Day. There's no doubt about that.
Oh, I think that's true. And here's my prediction. They're going to pass something. Trump is going to declare victory, and it will take us about 5 months to figure out what's in it. And when I say us, that includes everybody, including congressmen. The way these bills are put together, I worked in the Minnesota legislature for a little while, is you've got all these little groups and staffers who basically cut and paste stuff and throw it in the bill. Nobody has any sense at all about the comprehensive parts of it, which is why, you know, in the Senate, people were saying, I don't know how that got in there.
Right.
You don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. And, you know, it really is, whenever you have a big bill, and this is essentially an omnibus bill, nobody's got a clue what's in it. And, you know, it's watching the sausage made with the pig's lip and, you know, the other unappetizing parts.
You can, you know, what I've said from the beginning, and I think you and I have talked about this, you can say, and you can have a gut reaction, Elon is calling it, you know, GOP is the Porky Pig Party right now. There's a lot of things in here that I question. I wonder, and I don't even know the answer to what they did with some of the green energy, you know, incentives, because I was told that they put some of that stuff back in that Republicans in the House did not want in. But what happens in a situation like this is you have to, especially in this particular case, you got to pass something, get something across the finish line, or everyone's taxes go up. So
that's 100% right. And if I were a congressman, I would sit down, have a long drink with Thomas Massie and Chip Roy, and basically tell them, I'm 100% with you. I agree with everything you say, but I'm going to vote for the bill because the alternative is worse. The alternative is massive tax increases. And I'll tell you, the one place where Elon Musk is wrong is that, you know, it is true that the deficit is going to go up, but most of the increase in the deficit is just the expansion of the tax cuts. And
right,
90%
it's the,
of
the... Yeah. It's the Washington math, right? Yeah, I pointed this out yesterday in the New York Times. They have this big graph of where all the spending occurs. And the line goes all the way across the page, and it's simply on extending the tax cuts. So that's just what happens with Washington. Same thing with Medicare and Medicaid, rather, because what happens is, and this is what's frustrating, sometimes what they do is they try to say, look, we're going to go back to the 2020 spending levels. In this case, they're not even doing that. They're still increasing the spending for Medicaid. They're just, in theory, no matter, you know, know, it depends on what the final version is here. They're slowing the growth from 5% to 2%. So the money is still increasing when it comes to Medicaid. They're just slowing the growth, and they're trying to put work requirements on some of this stuff as well, which I don't think is irresponsible. Now, as you probably know, we have a United States Senator here in Josh Hawley, who has been very vocal about the Medicaid situation. He's concerned about rural hospitals in Missouri. You had a couple other lawmakers. I guess Lisa Murkowski was certainly concerned about that as well. And that's part of the reason that the Senate, you know, changed some things. But they're still increasing the spending.
Yeah, I mean, almost everything we hear from everybody is political spin. The rural hospitals, that's a real issue because it just sort of boils down to population density. So if you don't have enough people, the number of hospitals that you have per person goes up because you're not serving, 10 square miles, you're serving 100 square miles. And so you're just going to, and still fewer people. But, when you look overall, the big cuts that they're making there all have to do with cutting out illegal immigrants and cutting off the 35-year-old men in mom and dad's basements. And, we can tweak other things to make sure that we're not cutting off basic services. But, 90% of what you hear is political spin. If Joe Biden had put this bill forward, Democrats would be, screaming this is the best thing since sliced bread, and Republicans would be all against it.
One of the things I think that gets frustrating to me, I remember having conversations with Paul Ryan about this back when he was, the House Ways and Means Committee. Why can't we ever get back to, this is what I think a lot of people are thinking out loud. All right, let's extend the tax cuts. Let's not do an omnibus bill. Let's just focus on that. Let's not worry about this other stuff right now. But that's not how Washington works, unfortunately. And that's where you get all this controversy. Because let's say you're just extending the tax cuts, which I think is possible. You could introduce legislation to just do that. You might even have Democrats that come over on board, but they're going to vote party line because of all this other nonsense and because the midterms are 18 months away.
Yeah, I mean, there's something called regular order, which, never happens anymore. But the way that Congress is supposed to work is they're supposed to have a series of appropriations bills, separate bills for separate things. And that is almost never happening in Washington anymore.
It used to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's the way that it is supposed to work. And, to bash Trump a little bit, we shouldn't have one big, beautiful bill. We should have a series of bills that are manageable, that people can understand. But, again,
that takes time, right? That takes time. And then that drags it out. And then you get to the political calculations of, oh, my, are we getting too close to election year? And then when election year comes around, everyone wants to be really, really cautious. Look, Trump's already threatening Tom Massie to primary him. And by the way, I can understand Chip Roy and some of the other, conservatives in Congress being concerned about some of this. Tom Massie's lost me completely because I don't even know why he's a Republican, period, at this point.
Well, Massey is Massey. He's a party of one. And I've known a lot of mavericks like Massey. My wife works for one here in Minnesota. They have a North Star that is very much their North Star and they're not team players.
Yeah, he doesn't waver at all, though. Yeah, he's very consistent, I think I would say that. But which is why I like Chip Roy, because Chip Roy takes a stand, and he certainly took a stand in some of the, if you go back to Kevin McCarthy in the speaker's race, he comes out sometimes, I think, as a voice of reason, and it'll be interesting. If he's a yes on this, we're certainly going to want to know why he's a yes on this, and he'll have to explain it. Hey, while I have you here, David Strom from Minnesota, you mentioned Minnesota. I was off a couple of weeks ago. You know, what happens with a lot of the big stories, I'm even going to ask my friend John Ziegler about this later this afternoon, because there's questions about why they're not really rebuilding the Palisades very, quickly in the aftermath of all the wildfires. So we get all that coverage earlier. A couple weeks ago, you had the terrible, I would just call them assassinations. I know that your wife, as you indicated, works in the legislature. Has there been any new additional information on those shootings from a few weeks ago or not? Because we certainly don't get it here in Missouri.
Yeah, I was asking my wife about this because I pay more attention to the national news than the local news. And I was telling her, it disappeared. She said, well, you know, there's stuff in the local papers. And the problem is that, as you would expect, the guy was not politically motivated. He was a loser and a nut. And, you know, he's one of these guys who always wanted to be important. He never was, you know, even, you know, the things you heard about him working for Tim Walz. Well, that just turned out to be he was a volunteer on a state committee, which is all about a prestige thing. You know, he's the guy who volunteered. So it disappeared because it didn't fit a narrative. Everyone wanted to, you know, put the blame on someone else when it turned out, as it usually does, that the guy just was a nutcase. And
well, we have a lot of those, right? We had one in Idaho this week, unfortunately. They're still out there.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're a country of 330 million people. And even if it's 0.01% of people who are, you know, just totally schizo nuts, that winds up being a lot
still,
of people.
That's still a number. There's no doubt. David Strom, have a great Independence Day. Always appreciate having you on here, and we'll talk soon.
All right. Thanks.
I'm going to get into the Penn settlement also, or what they agreed on Leah Thomas, because that's fascinating. Riley Gaines weighs in. It's coming up next. You're a swimmer. Were you ever a competitive swimmer? I can't remember.
No.
Okay.
No,
well,
no.
Here are the records that the University of Pennsylvania has for women's swimming. In the 100 free, it was Leah Thomas at 47.37 in 2022. In the 200 free, it was a minute 41.93 in 2021. In the 500 free, it was 4 minutes, 33 seconds, 24 tenths of a second, is that how we put that?
Yeah.
In 2021. Those have all been removed right now. Linda McMahon, the education secretary, I know, thank God,
yes.
Right?
We've signed an agreement with them, and we hope that that agreement is going to be a template for other universities who acknowledge that there is no room for men and women's sports. The university is apologizing. It is taking away the titles that were incorrectly given to men. We've righted a wrong today.
So they write it or wrong. I think what you're going to hear from some folks, including Jen Say, who is going to visit us in the 5 o'clock hour, is this is just at Pennsylvania. Now, will it lead to bigger things? I don't know.
And did they only do this because they were sued?
Yes,
and then
probably
had to do it. So I love how they say, oh, well, you know what? Oopsie. But really, we only are doing this because we got sued.
Well, these are women, and we've had them on the air, right? We've had Paul Scanlon on the air. We've had, I've had Riley on the show when I filled in for Brian Kilmeade. I haven't had her on this show. But these are women who were forced to be in in the same locker room. So partial victory. Look, Riley says this is great.
I feel like pigs are flying. I feel like hell has frozen over. So it is a fantastic day, of course, for sanity, for common sense, but I think more broadly for women, for humanity, for the little girl that I'm growing inside of me right now.
So one of the things that's interesting, and I don't have a lot of time here before the end of the hour, is the, and I've mentioned this before, and I've pointed to Ben Hockman, who has blocked me on the X, formerly Twitter. He's one of the sports guys at the Post-Dispatch. And we got into this debate on Twitter a couple years ago, and I think he's just a coward when it comes to this stuff. He even asked me, he says, well, what would you do if, you know, your daughter came out as gender fluid or confused about their gender? And my answer was quite definitively, well, I certainly at a young age wouldn't hop her up on puberty blockers or anything like that, which seems to be, you know, the go-to on the part of these gender nuts out there. So we've learned that that's going to stop, thank God, to Jamie Reed here in St. Louis. But the thing that's always fascinating to me, and I don't have an explanation for it, and Riley highlights it here, what is it about the sports media people like Ben Hockman at the Post-Dispatch? Listen to the way that ESPN covered this yesterday.
Look back at 2021, 2022. Of course, they took the side of the man. They celebrated him for Women's History Month. It was this huge piece put together saying how brave he was, how resilient he was, how he has conquered these barriers to achieve the seemingly impossible and win a national title in the women's division. Like totally took his side initially. I think they faced, of course, a lot of backlash for this even back in 2022 or 2023. But to now, I think in these past two or so years, they've remained relatively quiet on this issue. But then yesterday they post and their headline is University of Pennsylvania bans trans women from sports. First of all, That's the headline that you're going to draw. No mention of the women who will receive their rightful national championship. Wow. People like Emma Wyatt. You're not going to mention her at all?
You know, it's outrageous. Really, let me go to my Twitter feed, because one of the things I retweeted today from Keith Olbermann, he's another one. He's crazy. He goes on in the aftermath of this, and he says, wanted to congratulate Whiny Gaines on now being able to say that she finished tied for fourth, not tied for fifth, in the Leah Thomas race. And Riley's response was perfect. She goes, thank you. And while you're keeping track, make sure to congratulate Emma Wyatt, who she just mentioned there, the right national champ in the 500 freestyle, too. Because, and then she says, if you're insinuating fifth in the nation is bad, think about that.
Right.
Fifth in the nation. She says, what do you call a man who ranks 462nd nationally in the men's category? Here's another thing that's interesting here. I always forget sometimes, you know how they call it a dead name of someone? What,
yeah.
Is it Tim Thomas? You remember?
Leah's name?
Yeah,
is?
Leah's
no.
name. But you know what's interesting about that is I have the advantage here where I have my iPad in front of me and I could Google that right now. And when you Google that, you can't even find, this is what happens with these social media crowds, you can't even find the answer to that. Like if you go to Wikipedia right now, it's actually Will. Now I had to scroll down. But if you go to Wikipedia on Leah Thomas, they have nothing to say about, you know, the dead name. They consider Leah Thomas a woman. Riley Gaines, rightfully, ripping ESPN.
That is literally crazy. This is a sports, network. These are sports journalists. These are sports analysts. Like, these people, if anyone would understand what we're dealing with here, you would imagine that it's the people working at ESPN. But of course, remember, they're owned by Disney. And I think that ties a lot of them up. They have a whole lot of what I would describe as activists.
Yeah, woke activists. And some of them, like Sam Ponder and, you know, Sage Steele, have kind of broken away from the pack, thank God. But it's embarrassing the way that sports journalism doesn't cover the real aspect of women being damaged by this stuff.
It really is. And they finally have to have the court say, okay, we're going to have to go to biology here.
Yeah.
Which is what everybody who is sane has thought from the beginning.
The question now is, what will some of these other schools do? And what will the NCAA do? Stay tuned for that.
Get more at 971talk.com.